listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Dear Mrs. Lingle by Abigail Santa Maria. Lingle had a lingering concern, though, about saying the wrong thing, which she eventually did in a letter about motherhood ending with the line, "And to me, you too are a son." This was triggering to Rockman. He remembered a white police officer calling his adult father boy. He did not know that Lingle had other informally adopted children whose photos dotted her apartment walls. He responded gently, "While I am deeply touched that you would accept me, too, this close to your heart, and consider me a son, I wish that we could become equally close relatives without looking upon it as a mother-son relationship." He asked her to remember that it was historically inappropriate to make reference to a black man in a paternalistic or maternalistic manner. That was the way of the slave master. For years, the two worked intensely on Razor Blade, he writing and revising chapters, she critiquing them, helping him hone characters, illuminating the narrative approach of showing versus telling. "I do not see the prison well enough." Speaking truths. "I doubt if any children's editor is going to let you use MF more than once, if that." The two shared hopes that a wider audience would bear witness to his American nightmare. She suggested he consider writing a memoir in the style of Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, a book Rockman had read and enjoyed. But still in his 20s, he wisely deferred to his older self. "So many of my most important irons are still in the fire, so many contradictions unresolved. The time wouldn't be right for at least a couple years," he thought. Another short story Lingle helped him with, The Action Comes, won first place in the fiction category of the 1978 Penn Prison Writing Awards. He used the $100 prize money to buy a yellow bicycle for his 7-year-old son, born 2 weeks after his sentencing. When Rockman's ancient typewriter broke down, impeding his progress, Lingle lobbied Penn for a grant to buy a new one. "I find him an extraordinarily talented and interesting young man," she wrote to Marone at Penn, "and anything I can do to make life more possible and more fruitful, I want to do." Penn awarded Rockman $100 toward a $259 Smith Corona portable with cartridges. She paid the difference, but didn't tell Rockman. Lingle shared chapters of Razor Blade with her literary agent, but the novel would never be published. The manuscript has disappeared. Detritus of the years, perhaps, or else destroyed in the typical tumult of prison that scattered so much of their correspondence. Periodically, Rockman was thrown in the hole, a sensory deprivation cell where he was consumed by the fear of coming out weeks later to find all of my work lost. Profoundly disturbed, Lingle offered to enlist the Bishop of New York, who is known for taking on unpopular cases. Rockman promised to tell her when the time was right for such help. "Whatever life has in store," he wrote to her on January 2, 1980, "I move into this new year with less bitterness, and therefore more love, more life in my heart because of your friendship." He refused despair, even after a knife attack that fall left his back permanently scarred. There were reasons to hope. A 1980 Michigan Supreme Court decision changed the felony murder law under which Rockman had been convicted. His undergraduate professor and friend Gloria House organized the Free Ahmad campaign, and the ensuing years were full of petitions, parole board appeals, appeals to Detroit legislators, and extensive coverage in the Detroit Free Press. Next photos, a tilted planet. Rachman and his cousin in the state prison of Southern Michigan Yard, where guard towers loomed overhead. And Ivory Tower, the Cathedral Church of St. John the Divine library study, where Lingle served as librarian, remains largely unchanged today. The surviving Lingle-Rachman letters are almost all from the four-year period of 1976 to 1980, predating these efforts. Rachman began coursework toward an M.A. in history with the goal of earning a doctorate through the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. He was shuffled around five different facilities between 1980 and 1990. The noise, smoke, and overcrowding hampered his ability to write. "These are very harsh days for me, old friend," he wrote to Lingle in 1990. Gray hairs flecked his beard. His son was a sophomore at Ohio State. He grieved the lost years. "When I think about all of the pain that has occupied his life because of my not being there, tears well up in my eyes." Finally, in November 1992, Michigan's governor commuted Rachman's sentence. The man who pulled the trigger had been paroled in 1983. He was 41 years old and had spent more than 21 of those years behind bars. Rachman began volunteering at the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice in Ann Arbor and was soon hired as associate director, a crucial first-paying job after prison, by the center's director, Toby Hannah Davies. He was brilliant and humble and had a calm spirit no matter what was going on, she says, a person of solid integrity, wise. Months later, they were astonished to discover that they both knew Madeline Lingle. Hannah Davies and her siblings had grown up with Lingle's children in the tiny New England farming village of Goshen, Connecticut, where the author lived in the 1950s at her country home, Crosswicks. "I take your wisdom very seriously," Rachman had written to Lingle in 1987, "and inshallah, I will one day be the marvelous teacher you feel I can be." 20 years after that letter, he published his doctoral dissertation as his first book, The Regime Change of Kwame Nkrumah, Epic Heroism in Africa and the Diaspora, and earned tenure as Associate Professor of History at the University of Michigan in Dearborn. He was giving of himself and available to students in a way that I've never seen from any other professor, says Joe Lunn, a history professor on the committee that interviewed Rachman. The two later became good friends. Rachman invested especially in the marginalized on campus, including Muslim students who felt under siege in the decade following 9/11, recalls Lunn. "Dr. Rachman became like a father to a lot of students," says Natasha Gilbert, a student in his History of the Civil Rights Movement course and president of the Black Student Union, for which Rachman served as faculty advisor. Gilbert emphasized the power for Black teenagers of the presence of a professor of color on campus. Black men in particular would literally cling to Dr. Rachman. He was always an ear to listen, but he was also a voice of reason and an advocate. Lingle died the year before Rachman earned tenure. Though they never met in person, the two kept in touch sporadically by phone and mail until her declining health became an obstacle. She would have been proud to see him named College Professor of the Year in 2013 by the Michigan Council for Social Studies. "Madeline and I once discussed Dr. King's conception of the beloved community," he would write, reflecting on his teaching achievements. Believers in God and a better world constantly should strive to create this community by their actions unto the least of these. Rockman never published fiction, but he demonstrated his penetrating storytelling ability in personal narratives and op-eds printed in the Detroit Free Press, and in a deeply researched essay on the rise and fall of the Black Panther Party in Detroit for Liberated Territory, Untold Local Perspectives on the Black Panther Party. Through it all, he remembered Lingle's long-ago suggestion that he write a memoir. By 2013, he had at last nearly completed that work, all but one chapter, the one about Madeline's crucial presence during those years in prison. She was a significant spiritual guide for me when I was in the dismal crypts, he told Hannah Davis, a lifeline. If only he had their letters and permission to quote from hers. Hannah Davis put him in touch with Lingle's granddaughter, Charlotte Jones Voiklis, who now manages Crosswicks Limited. Glad to help, Voiklis searched boxes of her grandmother's papers and scanned all the letters she could find. Lingle had often kept carbons. Voiklis and Rockman soon began a correspondence of their own. He sent her a photo of himself with his three young children and chapters of his memoir. In a skillfully paced narrative, he at long last wrote his American nightmare. By September 2015, Voiklis was trying to find Rockman a literary agent. His writing was so good and beautiful, and his story so compelling, that I wanted to help get it out there, she says. But he abruptly stopped responding to emails. Months later, she learned that Rockman had died on September 21st of a sudden heart attack at the age of 64. The memoir has never been published. In 2018, the centennial year of Lingle's birth, Voiklis was searching for special ways to honor her grandmother's legacy. She had long before embraced Ava DuVernay's adaptation of Wrinkle out that March. I'm really flabbergasted, says DuVernay, when she recently learned of the Lingle-Rockman friendship. It affirms something for me within her work that I saw and was wildly attracted to, which was a humanity and a respect for everyone's dignity. When Voiklis attended a PEN America event that April and mentioned her grandmother's connection, she saw another opportunity. Kate Smeissner, the current director of what is now called PEN America's Prison and Justice Writing Program, hadn't known of the correspondence either. Much of the program's history had been lost, forgotten, or buried in archives at Princeton University Library. Besides, not all correspondences have been so rich or successful. In 1981, Norman Mailer lobbied for the parole of his own talented correspondent, Jack Henry Abbott. Weeks after his release, Abbott killed a man. William Styron, Edward Albee, and other PEN members attempted damage control, but the organization was accused of encouraging criminals. In 1989, some members of the executive board decided to dissolve the program. Resources were spread thin, and what business did writers have with inmates anyway? But at the next board meeting, Larry McMurtry, newly elected president of PEN America, stood up. You can kill this program, he said, but you can't do it on my watch. The vote was canceled. By the time Voiklis met Meissner, more than 300 mentorships were underway. Carmen Maria Machado, author most recently of In the Dream House, a memoir, refers to her correspondence with incarcerated writer Greg Goodman as a real gift. Goodman, who was recently released after nearly 30 years in prison, has published numerous pieces of work. I gained confidence, Goodman says, of his work with Machado. I gained a sense of validation. Voiklis shared the letters with Meissner, and with support from Crosswicks Limited, PEN created the Lingle-Rockman Prize for Mentorship to honor mentorships in PEN America's prison writing program. Meissner said the letters will become training materials. There's no sense of I'm here to help you. There's no sense of, wow, this makes me interesting and cool because I'm doing this work. It feels authentic, open, and like two people coming to the page, curious about what will arrive. Mystics and clowns. The Capitol riot brimmed with fascist symbols. Sound and Fury, Signifying Everything, by Jeff Charlotte. With opening illustration by Anthony Grace, which shows various inflammatory flags referring to Trump, a gallows, and crowd members approaching the Capitol. On a certain January 6th, the Trump dream that's proven more contagious than the mutant B117 finally fully crossed over in real life into the material plane. It was the delusion he rode in on in 2016 and the hallucination in which he himself walks, no longer a con man, now a believer. That summer, when he averted his eyes from an interviewer as he murmured of dark shadows, it was clear the shadows of his hateful self-obsession had come home to haunt. But what happened in Washington, and at armed protest in at least a dozen state capitals around the country, was no haunting. For the last 4 years, and then some, Trump herded a too-compliant press into pens at his rallies, and used them like props for his rage, turning his mobs to scream at them. In one tiny sideshow of the insurrection, the screamers knocked down the metal barricades and finally attacked, beating cameras with flagpoles. One man preached vengeance, start hunting them, meaning journalist, down one by one. An insurrectionist in Mary Jane's and a pink beret sifted for souvenirs. Most took pictures. And yet the attack was not just symbolism. All of it, the spectacle and its instant smartphone memorializations, comprises the language of fascism, different mainly in scale from the trophy photos of lynchings that once circulated as postcards. Fascism has been a visual language ever since its embrace by Futurism, the early 20th century Italian movement of art and design. So too today, a visual grotesque that's left too many of us grasping for words even as we dwell on scenes from the insurrection. If we're not careful, we'll simply spread the contagion, echo, 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 like the battle cry of the right-wing social media network Parler, in which an echo is similar to a retweet. The grinning fool in a pom-pommed Trump beanie, waving as he makes off with the House Speaker's podium, Florida man Adam Johnson, another toting a Confederate flag, Kevin Seafried of Delaware, between portraits of Vice President John C. Calhoun, slavery's most eloquent defender, and Charles Sumner, nearly beaten to death on the Senate floor for his abolitionism. Security, guns drawn and aimed at the shattered window of the House chamber's door, a rioter's face peering in like Jack Nicholson in The Shining. Then there was the yet blunter collapse of history by meme, a rioter in the Capitol wearing a hoodie with the words Camp Auschwitz wrapped around a skull. His name is Robert Keith Packer. This is fascism's visual trap, from the black, white, and red of the swastika to the death's head Punisher skull that's become a de facto symbol of Trumpism, from the patch worn by the zip-tie guy Eric Munchel to the pin on Sean Hannity's lapel. Literally cartoonish, a language of brute spectacle that's hard to ignore. Look, and you're cursed by that which is ugly in the deepest sense. Look away, and you neglect the threat at our door, or rather inside the house. The task, then, is translation, to render that which seems shocking instead banal, to root fascist proclamations of revolution in the history that names them merely small-minded manifestations of defeated ideas, less than ideas, vanity, dull-eyed. Consider three of our newly elected representatives, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Georgia, Lauren Boebert, Colorado, and Madison Cawthorn, North Carolina. Each stoked the insurrection, but they're notable not so much for their ideology. Other members run, just as extreme, as for the ways in which they flaunt it. Green's best-known ad featured her in a taut black suit and aviator shades, gripping an assault rifle next to the disembodied gray scale heads of three members of the squad. Women of color, drained of actual color. Because color, blonde hair, bright red lipstick, like the gun, like power, in the white supremacist imagination, belongs to whiteness. In the grammar of white supremacy, everything does, as W.E.B. Du Bois observed a century ago in The Souls of White Folk. I am given to understand that whiteness is the ownership of the earth forever and ever, amen. So it was that Boebert stormed the Capitol in an ad titled Mission Boebert, released 3 days before the insurrection. In it, she swaggers down a D.C. back alley, declaring she'll carry her Glock, seen as if by X-ray beneath her jeans, to Congress, because Washington's among the top 10 most dangerous cities. It isn't. but it is, by most counts, among the top 10 black cities. Before that, she posed often with a handgun strapped around the thigh of her tight jeans, and in at least one picture wearing Daisy Dukes, peeking over her shoulder as she dangled an assault rifle behind her. Rock-jawed young Cawthorn, meanwhile, is more of a concealed carry man. He made sure to let his fans, for that's what his supporters are, know he was packing at the insurrection, inside the Capitol and before, when he ranted at the rally in the style of the Führer, as he referred to Hitler when he made a pilgrimage to the dictator's eagle's nest, wearing a vintage-style shooting jacket and tight leather gloves, as if cosplaying a fascist of the old school. To the ardent, these images are like reactionary pin-ups, thrilling even as they lend the illusion of gravitas to the more soberly attired leaders of the rightist surge, the Hawleys and Cruises. Beneath the pin-up's gloss of titillation and transgression, the real action is reassurance, the promise that white beauty and white power endure. Men will be manly, women will wear short shorts, both will carry guns. Cawthorn reassures the base that you can support politicians without paying fealty to suits, weak, whiny tools such as Lindsey Graham. As women, Boebert and Green offer a model of feminine authority which uses that power, visualized as an assault rifle, to make them even more traditionally desirable. Guns, curves, they've got it all. Fascists know, explicitly or implicitly, that all of these images, Boebert, sexy with her gun, or the horned man flexing in the Senate, do their work for them. They cosplay for the same reason Trump danced to YMCA at his rallies, because it works. It draws the eye. It seems to express earnestness and humor at the same time, the layers of meaning that can produce a symbol. For instance, the image of a flag distributed by Trumpist lawyer L. Lynn Wood after the insurrection. On a field of black, surrounded by six white stars, the six states stolen from our president, the image of a white woman is silhouetted against a blood-red Capitol. It is Ashley Babbitt, the insurrectionist killed by a Capitol police officer. A blue star marks her bullet wound, an innocent murdered for her patriotism. The actual Babbitt led a complicated life. The figure in the flag is a visual descendant of Virginia Dare, the first English baby born in North America, who now lends her name to the white supremacist site V-Dare and every white woman after her in the rancid mythology of lynching. We've seen this picture before. Like ironic racism or the Camp Auschwitz hoodie, it not only lacks but actually denies depth. It is complex, but two-dimensional. A conspiracy theorist map of connections. It is flat by design, the better to replicate itself. We are Ashley Babbitt, as one account on the platform Gab puts it, collectivizing grievance and martyrdom, copy after copy. On the National Mall, insurrectionist erected gallows, a cross and a gallows. This phrase, for that's what it is in the fascist tongue, bears emphasis lest we ever forget the vanity Trump and his believers mean by the word sacred, as in the sacred landslide. What they mean, what fascism always means, is the flattening, stories reduced to memes. The cross and the gallows, of course, are symbols too, each rich with layers of meaning, nuance, and contradiction. But their juxtaposition cancels each other out. Such is the essence of fascism's appeal, that it loathes life is as obvious as its affection for skulls, but it denies the reality of death as well by considering it so glibly. Executing politicians? Lulls. For whom does the insurrectionist noose hang? For whom does it not? Of course it's all just talk or just theater, as so many pundits have declared, until it isn't. We must learn the language of fascism, because for the foreseeable future, that moment will always be coming. Learn just enough that we'll never have to speak to it, just as scientists study viruses so they can develop vaccines. You have to momentarily see, as fascists do, a world flattened to two dimensions, one in which the horned dude, the QAnon shaman, can pose as both clown and mystic, because he's not really either. And Camp Auschwitz, always now, and thus always funny, it's a joke, precisely because none of it, the theater, the cosplay, the guns, the shattered glass, ever is. Hack the System. Tony Sia's tragic death reveals the dark side of Silicon Valley's biohacking obsession by Nick Bilton. As news broke that Tony Sia, the founder of Zappos, had died in a fire 1 year ago, the day after Thanksgiving, It was almost incomprehensible. Near billionaires don't die in fires, and they particularly don't die alone in a 300-square-foot shed, surrounded by some old gym equipment, a pink and white striped beach chair, bottles of Fernet Branca liqueur, and nitrous oxide chargers. Over the past decade, the Silicon Valley tech rich have come to be seen almost as deities. They make up almost half of the 20 richest people on the planet, according to Forbes, and are quoted, lauded, and defended by legions of fans as if they were some sort of doctrinal beings, saints with iPhones. When they go on silent retreats and meditate for days on end, it's seen as proof they are close to some sort of transcendental plane, and when they return to normal life, they will explain how they can fix civilization. Those who push themselves to extremes by hacking their bodies, drinking Soylent instead of consuming real food, or foregoing sustenance altogether, are not seen as odd, but considered on the bleeding edge, as if they were just doing this to show us mere mortals how in control they are of their own lives. Sia, like many tech titans, found success young. He sold his first company to Microsoft for $265 million when he was 24 years old, and later co-founded Zappos, which he sold to Amazon for $1.2 billion in 2009. Sia adopted a new work ethic, known as holacracy, where employees have no job titles and self-organize to fulfill the task of the company. He came to be known as someone who shunned the money he had made. He lived in a tiny Airstream in a parking lot and just wanted to make the world, or at least Las Vegas, a better place. But Sia was haunted by his success and had also ventured somewhere dark to the extremes of biohacking and food deprivation. In the months before he died, Sia's body had deteriorated to just 100 pounds and was suffering from lack of nourishment. At one time, he had put himself on an extreme 26-day alphabet diet, during which he only ate foods starting with the same single letter each day. He was anxious, depressed, and self-destructive, as his longtime friend, the singer Jewel, said, and in addition to becoming addicted to oxygen deprivation and whippets, he was also paying friends to be around him in Park City, Utah, showing that this public presentation of a transcendental life is really, at the end of the day, mostly just bullshit. A few founders will create this made-up person, and then everyone else in tech wants to emulate it. A Silicon Valley venture capitalist told me, it was the same with Steve Jobs, where people wanted to wear a black turtleneck and become vegan. Now these tech bros want to be a part of this spiritual group of drug users, partying on private islands, but in reality, it's more like a cult. Polls, research, and those screens we all stare at incessantly show how important wealth and fame have become in modern American life. At the top are people like Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, and Elon Musk, who have gone from being like you and me to being the richest and most powerful people on Earth. But no matter how much money they make, how many people use their platforms or buy their products, or how high they are on any given list, it's never enough. Mark Zuckerberg doesn't wake up every morning and say to himself, "Holy shit, 2.8 billion people use Facebook." Instead, he wakes up every morning and says, "Why isn't the other half of planet Earth using Facebook?" one tech founder told me. Jeff Bezos is no different. He recently stepped down as the CEO of Amazon, not to retire as the richest man on Earth or spend more time with his family, but to focus on other pursuits. The Washington Post, trying to beat Musk in the new space race, helping push Amazon to be even more innovative. The next tier of tech leaders, billionaires or decamillionaires like Kaseya, Snap CEO Evan Spiegel, and Spotify CEO Daniel Ek, are also constantly at war with their own demons about how they got to this rare place, terrified that they might lose their standing, and riddled with the angst of imposter syndrome or worse. According to people close to Hisaya, some believe the pressures of having made it, both financially and to a certain level of tech stardom, were simply too much. No wonder we've entered a new era in Silicon Valley, with the tech elite having their own period of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, often without the rock, the roll, or even the sex. Last year, a number of rich founders began experimenting with microdosing drugs to make it through the day. As two people with knowledge of these habits have told me, by taking tiny amounts of MDMA and LSD and a long list of mushrooms to help take the edge off, but not so much that you're seeing tie-dyed dolphins or 3D cartoon characters chasing you down Market Street. For Musk, the pressures of being at the top led the board of Tesla to worry about the founder's use of Ambien to get to sleep each night after the excruciating toll running Tesla had taken on him. Some have even begun building their own microdosing labs, hiring chemists and pharmaceutical scientists to make bespoke batches of hallucinogens to pop like Skittles when reality gets a little too real. During the pandemic, I've heard of founders going to far-off places to experiment with ayahuasca, peyote, and the new drug of choice, DMT, a synthetic drug that one person told me was like doing 10 years of psychotherapy in 5 minutes. Then there's the body hacking, which first made its way into the mainstream in 1984 by way of the sci-fi subculture novel Neuromancer, but has since leapt off the page and into Palo Alto, where everyone seems to want to outdo their cohorts by pushing their bodies to extremes. You've got the Dorseys of the world bragging about how little they eat each day, the Zuckerbergs boasting of killing their own food, and an army of nerds now wearing every tracking device imaginable, from rings that follow your sleep to real-time sugar monitoring devices you inject into your arm, and then experimenting with all forms of starvation and sleep habits to show how in control they are of their bodies. There's intermittent fasting, working under infrared heat lamps, calculating ketones, and working with do-it-yourself surgeons to implant magnets and microchips. I think this is all a result of a complete detachment from authenticity by these tech founders. They present a version of themselves that isn't real, and then when they look in the mirror, they see how inauthentic they really are. And the only way they can handle the illusion they've created is through drugs, said one Silicon Valley insider who often spends time with the biohacking-obsessed ultra-rich. It's all synthetic, and it's all an illusion. The pandemic only heightened this, with people slipping into more extreme activities in their quest for control. One Silicon Valley founder, who sold his company to Google years ago, told me that the year that followed the sale, when he had gone from an average American worrying about paying rent each month to seeing 7 zeros at the end of his bank account, was one of the most miserable times of his life. "You think it's going to solve all these problems," the founder told me, "but it just creates so many more issues, both psychologically and existentially. You don't know what to do with yourself anymore." For Hisaya, the only thing he could do was run away from his demons and the reality in which he found himself imprisoned. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco. Naomi Campbell, the superest of supermodels, talks going on safari and the one piece of jewelry she's worn for 25 years. What is your current state of mind? I'm trying to stay positive. I guess the word would not be flowing with life, but adapting. Adapt and not really think about it. Just go with it. What is your favorite journey? One of my favorite journeys is when I travel to Kenya or elsewhere in Africa, go into the bush, do a safari, and live in a camp. I feel just like a speck, minute, and fitting in with nature. Which living people do you most admire? Nurses and Stacey Abrams. What is your idea of perfect happiness? These days, it's good health and peace. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'm not going to change anything about myself. I am happy and blessed with what God gave me, and I really have nothing to complain about. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? I mean, and so. Which historical figure do you most identify with? I think right about now I could say Rosa Parks. I feel like we're going back, regressing, but we can't allow that to happen. How would you like to die? In my sleep. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Disloyalty. When and where were you happiest? When I am anywhere in the African continent. What are your favorite names? Biblical names. Which talent would you most like to have? The talent of healing, definitely. What is your motto? From Nelson Mandela, you will sleep when you die. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? I wish we lived closer together. What is your most treasured possession? I don't know if I really have a treasured possession, but I have worn a waist chain for over 25 years that's become a part of me. Where would you like to live? I love traveling, so that's a very hard question for me to answer. I'd definitely like to live in Africa, and that's something I'm looking to implement in my life. Who is your favorite writer? Brian Weiss. Who are your heroes in real life? Nelson Mandela, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King Jr., Emmett Till. What is your favorite occupation? Sharing my knowledge or whatever I can of myself to help others in any capacity. What is the quality you most like in a man? Loyalty. What is the quality you most like in a woman? Loyalty. What do you most value in your friends? Loyalty and honesty. What is it that you most dislike? I don't even know these days, but what I can tell you I like is being your most authentic self. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Naomi Campbell. In the next installment, we'll begin reading from the annual holiday issue with articles on Jennifer Lawrence, Robert Plant, and Alison Krauss, as well as Sebastian Younger and Sarah Everard. All this and more in the next installment of Vanity Fair. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.